we turn inbound, we accelerate, we're probably about 15,000 feet, and both my wingman and myself, we drop two JDAMs. We take the building down, it collapses on itself. We see a couple of squirters or people that escaped from the building, but I think there was a total of nine in there, and we only saw two people escape. And then there were some special operations that cleaned those folks up. So there was a ton of excitement on the radio. We still didn't know what had happened. We went and got some gas. We weren't returned to the Harry S. Truman, and we went into intelligence. And a lot of cheering going on, a lot of high-fiving going on. And we were like, what do we do? You know, we still had no clue what we did. We were excited. It was pure luck that we were there. But at the time, which was very satisfying to me, they were actually, the head of ISIS in the Nineveh province in Mosul was having a Ramadan breakfast. And he was the person who was responsible for commanding the execution of those 100 people in the first month. And we wound up, you know, getting him, his wife, and five or six other HBIs or high-value individuals that were in that building. I would say it didn't solve a lot, but it wound up cutting down for at least a few weeks on the violence that was in that region. But it was amazing to, again, go back and see some vindication for what he had commanded 5 months earlier. We wound up getting pure luck, but we're in the right place in the right time, and I'll take it.
Tower, Tamar 6 is released to you. Runway 4 left, wind 0-0 at 5. Quick takeoff.
Seat tied. Altimeter 0 eyes. We're clear for takeoff. Clear for the airspace.
Fire project 2.
My program curveballs at 3-5-4.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening. And if you're over on YouTube, thanks for watching. My guest today is Micah Peaches Porter. He started off his career in the Navy flying the F-18 Super Hornet. Spent a career flying that and transitioned to the Air National Guard after about a decade flying the F-16. He's currently a 757 and 767 captain. He had some hurdles getting into the military to begin with. We talked about that. We talked about his Navy flying career. I'm always interested about flying and hearing people land on the boat for whatever reason. So we definitely dig into landing on the boat, just how terrifying that really is. Some combat deployments, as well as a few other things. Peaches was a Top Gun graduate. He taught at the West Coast Weapons School. He was the West Coast Weapons School Fighter Pilot of the Year. There's some Navy lingo in here that I definitely butcher, and I want to make sure that it's clear. When you talk Top Gun graduate, Weapons School, there's a lot of crossing streams, and I definitely, at some point in this episode, will butcher Weapons School or Top Gun graduate, Instructor Pilot of the Year. And that's not Peach's fault. That's my fault. So I apologize. Take the hit. But Peach is quite a distinguished career with a lot going on. And I think you're going to enjoy this episode. If you're getting any value out of this, please take the time, leave a rating review over on Apple Podcasts. You can leave a 5-star review on Spotify. I don't think you can leave any words. But if you leave words on Apple, I'll see that. Make sure you're following the show over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. That, again, helps the show get shown to more people. And if you're liking this and you're watching over on YouTube, leave a comment, leave a like, and make sure you're subscribing to the YouTube channel. For everyone who's taking the time to do that, I appreciate that. Peaches is kind enough, again, to hang around for a There I Was story like many of the guests. And if you're interested in that, you can get that as an Apple Podcast subscriber or over on Patreon. All that stuff lives down in the description for links and so on and so forth. That's all the admin I have today. With that being said, let's get into the episode with Peaches. Peaches, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Happy to have you on here and look forward to chatting and cover a little bit about your career and what you've done and what you're doing today.
Awesome. Yeah, it's thank you very much for having me on the podcast, and look forward to the conversation we're getting ready to have.
Yeah, so I'm going to kick it off here with a bit of your bio. I'm probably going to skim the surface, and we'll dig down deep into this, but you're born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, which I think makes a lot of sense with your current job, which we can discuss later on. Single mom. You graduated high school as the leading all-time scorer for basketball, and that's the Restoration Christian High School. Off to Wesleyan to play for 2 years, and then wrapping up your collegiate basketball career at Anderson University. You've been accepted into OCS for the Navy with a flight contract, I believe, prior to September 11th. Discharge for vision, and then had to fight back to get into the Navy with a flight contract there. Super Hornet, Top Gun instructor, the Fighter Pilot of the Year 2013 out in the Pacific. Did some DevGru liaison there. And then eventually wrapping up your time in the Navy with it looks like a tour in Operation Inherent Resolve, expending the most bombs of any naval unit, the all-time record there. Separated from the Navy in 2016, transitioned to the greatest fighter ever created by man, the F-16. So that probably had to feel real nice. But 3 years flying the F-16, separated or retired from the military following a back surgery there. You're now flying the 757 and 767 as a captain. We can discuss that as well. You got a lot of other ventures with real estate, mentorship, and things of that nature. So we got a lot to dig in here, Peaches. So again, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Can you kick it off a little bit of what drove you, what made you want to join the military, specifically to your time frame? You mentioned you accepted OCS 2011, lots are 2001, September 11, 2001, all that's happening. A lot of things are going on in that time frame. But what was the drive? Did you always want to be a fighter pilot?
You know, it's a great question. Early on, my grandfather was actually a pilot in the Army Air Corps in World War II. And he flew multiple missions. He was one of the hump pilots that flew C-46s over the Himalayas into China and India. And wow. He wound up teaching my mother how to fly as well. So my mother was a private pilot. Tragically, both my grandmother and grandfather passed away in an airplane crash when I was about seven months old. So I never had a chance to meet them and hear the stories. But my mother always kind of kept their legacy really much alive. She always encouraged me to go into aviation. The path was long. It was not smooth. A lot of guys are pedigreed and, you know, go to the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy. But for me, my background or my childhood was a little bit rougher. My mother was married 3 times. I had a wonderful mother, but I didn't have any real male leadership in my life. And so that drove me to sports, playing sports nonstop. And also probably in a lot of areas led to me getting into some trouble. I was very competitive. Always liked to fight, not so much with fists, but very competitive. So my mother continued to encourage me to go into aviation. I went to college, like you said, to play basketball. I say play basketball jokingly because when I got to college, I'll never forget my college coach sitting me down and said, "Micah, I love your heart. We want you on the team, but I can't teach you how to be 6'3". You're just 5'9". So most of my playing time was at the on the bench cheering my other teammates on. But it was still a great experience. But I went to college for economics and finance. And although I did okay, I didn't really excel at it. I didn't love it. And I'll never forget, my mother finally talked me into going to take my first flight lesson in between my sophomore and junior year at college. And once that happens, we were talking a little bit before the podcast, when you're all in, you're all in. I was like, this is what I wanted to do with my life. And so I started dedicating all my time to flying and becoming a pilot. It's funny because even before college, my mother had to talk me out of enlisting into the Marine Corps. I always wanted to be in the military. It's always a portion of me. Probably my high school basketball coach, someone who was very instrumental in my life, kind of stepped in during those dead years of no real mentorship, was a Marine Corps drill instructor. He was a hard cat. It was hilarious. There were times where I'd be on the basketball floor and I'd make a mistake. And I mean, you could never get away with it today, but he'd grab you by your shirt collar and say a couple words that I won't say on the podcast and, you know, get your butt back in there and start playing. So he was very instrumental. I looked up to him, obviously looked up to my grandfather. On the other side, my grandfather on the other side was a Navy corpsman that was on Saipan, Tinian, and Leyte, and Iwo Jima. And it went through. So it was always kind of a portion of who I wanted to be. So once she had talked, once my mother had talked me out of going to college or going to college, not enlisting in the Marine Corps, I went. And when I found aviation, I was like, okay, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to go into the military. I want to serve and I want to be a pilot. So that's a little bit of the cliff notes of how I got from childhood up to joining the military.
Interesting. The aspect, you know, for your mother, who I, just from what you told, I can assume there's, like you mentioned, there's a lot of struggles going on there. But to lose her parents in aviation, very tragic. You know, aviation is one of those things, I don't know, it seems it can be very dangerous. I know you probably lost a lot of buddies. I've lost a lot of buddies. You just respect it, try to do well. But the fact that she still kind of pushed or said, hey, this is a viable career. This is be a good thing for you. I think is pretty miraculous because, you know, if you experience that kind of trauma, like, you know, most people, like the last thing you want to do is have a loved one go near something that could do that again, you know?
That was one of her largest gifts. My mother was an incredibly strong woman, but one of her gifts was being able to look at someone and evaluate them and see where they would be best at. And to your point, she was very close with her father. And so when she lost both of them at the same time, I think that affected her. And in fact, I know it affected her the rest of her life. Just a little bit of background on that. My grandfather was, again, a World War II pilot. He had over 10,000 hours. I actually went back. It's crazy. About 10 years ago, and I read the accident report, and they were killed in 1979. It's still online that you can read. And basically what happened was they were on an ILS, or actually it's probably more like a VOR approach, into a place called Folkston, Georgia. And there was a front that was coming through. There wasn't as much knowledge on weather patterns and wind shear and everything, and they were on short final, and they got hit by wind shear, which pushed them directly into, you know, a pine grove, something that we take for granted now with all the technology and weather radars and updates, but they didn't have back then. But it was interesting just to go back and read the process of what happened to my grandparents. But bottom line is, it was always a blessing to have a mother that could look at me and say, evaluate what I would be good at and push me in that direction.
Yeah, that's awesome. In college there, you obviously, you pick up a Navy contract. And I don't know if that's the right term for the Navy, but to go to Officer Candidate School, OCS, but you haven't graduated yet. What was, obviously you're pursuing that. Talk to me about the process and what was going through your mind and the efforts you're putting in to pursue that.
So right around my junior year is when I decided that I wanted to join the military and wanted to fly, and specifically I wanted to fly fighters. And so on top of my college work, I started flying on the side to get my private pilot's license and applied for the Navy. And as you know, in the Navy or the Air Force, it's all cyclical as far as how many candidates they wanted. And to be frank with you, I'm one of the most fortunate people to be in naval aviation because I did not have good grades. Most of the guys I was up against, you know, they were in the Naval Academy, they had a 3.8. I graduated with a stunning 2.9 GPA.
Hey, check the box.
Check the box, that's right. But I did like to fight, so that was part of it. So there was a huge need for naval aviators right around or before 2001, September 11, 2001. And so I was able to take the test and I passed. 2 weeks prior to September 11th, I swore into the Navy that after graduation, I would go and go to OCS and have a flight contract. And so that was very interesting. I'll never forget September 11th. You know, we were doing two practices a day for basketball, and I was on my way home from the first practice that started around 6 o'clock in the morning. I heard on the news as I was driving my car back to get ready for a statistics class that there was a plane that hit the World Trade Center. I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was a small plane. I thought that was really weird. And then when I walked in, my roommates were huddled around the TV and we watched the second plane hit the second World Trade Center. But I'll never forget the next day after that happened, my recruiter called me. And he was like, hey, listen, you can still back out if you want. And I remember thinking to myself, that's the weirdest question anybody's ever asked me, because that's the only reason why I wanted to join, is that I wanted to defend our country and I wanted to be a fighter. Some people join for other reasons. No reason's bad to go serve your country. But for me, it was to do that. So I was like, I'm not backing out. I'm ready to go. So as soon as I get done with graduation, went to OCS.
It's interesting he called you and gave you that option. I figured it'd be the other way around. You know, it's like, yeah, we got you now, right? And we're going to need the numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a bizarre conversation. You know, I would have thought the same thing. He was like, hey, you're not going to back out. You're not going to back out. I'm like, no, there's no chance now I'm backing out. Like, I'm here. I'm ready. So.
Interesting. So you graduate college, and then you're off to OCS. When do you have the vision issue?
So I probably had vision issues on one eye my whole life. But I never recognized it because it never became a big problem. I went to OCS for the first time. I graduated college in May of 2002. I wound up joining OCS in July of 2002. I think it was May or June, July, somewhere around that time frame, 2002. And I went through 12 weeks. And we in the Navy call it the NAMI whammy. NAMI is the medical group that has to clear you to become a pilot. And I went through the first time and they were like, hey, your eye failed just a little bit. You know, the right eye had an astigmatism that was just a little too much for us to accept. And so they said, we'll give you some time, but we would like to transfer you to become a weapons systems officer or a backseater, someone who works the weapons systems in the back of the airplanes. And I said, no, I want to be a pilot. That's the only thing I want to be. And so luckily at that point, I hadn't gone through ROTC. I hadn't gone to the academy and I hadn't taken any other money. So I was able to get a medical discharge from the Navy. The unfortunate thing for me is I went through another 8 weeks of OCS getting beat down by the Marine Corps drill instructors prior to exiting. But they put some pressure on me, but ultimately I knew, hey, listen, I want to be a fighter pilot. If not, then I'll do something else.
So when you got medically discharged, you still stayed in OCS, or you're just saying when you eventually went back, you obviously got round two of OCS.
Well, they gave me a little bit of time, or NAMI gave me a little bit of time in order to make up my decision on whether I wanted to take another job or not. So I couldn't make up my mind, and there was pressure. I mean, the drill instructors were pressuring me, the officers were pressuring me. Hey, take another job. You know, if you quit, you'll never be back. This is a black mark on your record. And I said, hey, listen, I want to be a fighter pilot, or I want to be out of the military. That's what I want to do. That's the way I want to serve. And then finally, after about 8 weeks, they got the point. They medically discharged me and I went home. So.
Yeah, that was. The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit GunsGarin.com/rain.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
That was a good call there on your part. But again, rolling the dice. And you said like two. Yeah, everyone's worried about end of the month numbers and quotas and things like that. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. So you just got to know what you want and I think be persistent. That's a good theme to carry through. This so the stigmatism, you obviously battle with that a little bit. What's the next couple steps? Because you end up getting it corrected and then obviously going into the Navy and eventually making it to the Viper. So tell me what transpired once you left OCS.
Sure. I left OCS and I was devastated, absolutely devastated. I came back to Southern Indiana. It's a suburb of Louisville, Kentucky. And I'll never forget this to the day I die. You know, you come back from OCS and everyone's looking at you like, hey, you quit. You're not going to be a naval aviator. and I joined a landscaping crew. So I went from 2 weeks earlier becoming a naval fighter pilot to now landscaping and lawn services. And I'll never forget my boss looking at me and saying, Micah, he was like, you know, you went to 4 years of college and I'm still making more money than you. And I was like, goodness gracious. That was a low part of my life. It was a low point, but it lit a fire under me. It lit an absolute fire under me to start pursuing even harder naval aviation, Air Force aviation, Marine Corps aviation, anything that would let me in. So I started applying. I wound up getting a procedure called PRK or photofractive keratotomy. It's an older style of LASIK surgery. It's pretty painful. And I wound up applying three more times. It's amazing. Right after September 11th or before September the 11th, there was a huge need for Navy pilots. And right after September 11th, there's no need whatsoever. And so with only having a 2.9 GPA, the only thing that I could change is flight time. So I started working as hard as I could and putting all my time into flying, building my ratings. And I talk about mentorship, kind of my heart for mentorship comes from some of the people that stepped into my life. It's incredible. For about a 2 week period, I tell the story, it's funny. There's a lot going on in my life, but I lived out of my car for 2 weeks because I was basically homeless. I lived at the airport, slept in the recliners, took showers. And there was a couple of people that stepped into my life. They saw how dedicated I was to aviation, what I wanted to do. There was a banker, a man named Ed Kane. He's about 84 now. I still have a good relationship with him. And a gentleman named Paul Newman, who was a captain at UPS. And they stepped into my life. They started mentoring me. They allowed me to work around their house, do odds and ends things. They had airplanes, allowed me to fly. You know, I talk about some people don't believe in faith. I'm a man of faith. I believe in the hand of providence. And I'll tell you, there is no reason why I should have gotten accepted. I wound up applying three more times for naval aviation. I was turned down every single time. And I was coming up on 26 years old. I was 25 at the time. And I was coming up. And I think at the time, the cutoff was about 27 and a half for you to get into aviation. And I couldn't get in. And I was turned down every single time. And it became more frustrating. So I wound up going around Southern Indiana and Louisville trying to meet anybody I could. And I wound up sitting down. This is the craziest story. I wound up sitting down at a VFW and having a beer, actually. And there was an older gentleman that was sitting down. I started telling my sob story. Because anybody that would listen, I needed to get it out that I wanted to be a naval aviator. And he was like, well, son, he was like, my son is a man named Captain Ed Bullion, who is head over Bupers, or the selection process that is in Millington, Tennessee. He was like, I'm going to put you in touch with him. I was like, you have to be kidding me, right? He was like, no, just a random conversation at a VFW. And the next day he gave me a number. I called Captain Ed Bullion. I remember him telling me, or asking me to tell my story. I told my story, and he said, well, drive down here, put on a suit, I'll interview. And if you pass interview, I'll give you a slot. So I put on a suit, I drove down to Millington, Tennessee, and 4 days later, I was accepted in Naval Aviation. So to me, it was God showing up, you know, just at the right time, because I'd honestly lost all hope of being a naval aviator at that point. But then I went through my second iteration of OCS in 2005. So between 2002 and 2005 was kind of that gap where I was reapplying for naval aviation.
The aspect I had not thought about until you mentioned it, obviously after 9/11, there was a surge in patriotism and there was not a recruiting problem. We've talked about on the podcast and other episodes, that's something that's not the case today. Air Force, Navy, I think every branch is struggling. They're missing their numbers. Retention is down, et cetera. So timestamp two, when you say you're reapplying three times, there are people that listen to this that are going through something similar. But in your time frame, like you said, the cutoff was like 28. We've keep bumping out the age the you can join. I think now it's like 33 or 30, I don't know. No one quote me on that, right? But what between the applications and getting turned down those three times, how much time transpired between each of those periods?
It was probably 8 months. So as soon as I saved enough money to get PRK and my eyes fixed, I reapplied. And so that application process typically takes about 6 months to complete. And so every 8 months I would get a rejection notice in the mail. And I remember the third time I did it, I went home and I tore my room up. Like, I had a room, I had some stuff in it. My girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, Jenna, was in town. She wasn't there for it, but I went home and I lost it. Cause this is just something that I wanted so badly. But it was probably an 8 month period between each one of them. So probably 24 months of constant rejection, by Bupers, for Naval Aviation. And finally that last time, Captain Ed Bilyon, which I've never met after that. I've always thought about reaching out to him or trying to find him, but was the person that opened the door that allowed me to become a naval aviator. So
that's incredible. It is networking, intervention of the hand of God there. It's pretty incredible. I think one thing too, random note, is I imagine as you went and got PRK, there are people, again, who probably listen to this that have some kind of medical thing they have to overcome. The documentation process that you go through and making sure that you do it the right way and dot your I's and cross your T's, because ultimately the military is going to look at if you had something that was corrective to make sure that it was done properly. So if you're one of those, I mean, it's fallen in this category where you need a waiver of some kind or some kind of procedure, make sure you figure out what the military needs before you go out and get something done.
And that's what I tell everyone. I try to mentor a lot of kids these days simply because people spoke into my life and mentored me and opened doors for me. But don't take no for an answer. You know, I think that's one of the things or one of the attributes that fighter pilots do best is we're going to press. We're going to press hard. And we're going to solve the problem. And a lot of times persistence pays off. I have a rule of threes that I always live by. If they tell you no the first time, always go back and ask again. If they tell you to no the second time, always ask again the third time. The reason why is because first time it's very easy to say no to a really good guy. Second time it's infinitely harder. And then the third time, if they tell you no, then maybe God's just saying, hey, the door's shut in your life. This isn't what I want for you. And then I'll stop beating my head against the wall. But it's going to take three times for me to quit.
That's great stuff. Talk to me about getting into pilot training. Was it tough for you? What was the experience going through naval aviation training?
So naval aviation training, like I said, I graduated the second time through OCS in 2005. And then did aviation preflight indoctrination, which is all the swim phys and survival swimming. And then I went to Corpus Christi for T-34s. Over the time frame that I'd been out of the military for that 3-year period, I was able to fly almost 1,000 hours. So looking back, yeah, honestly, it was a huge blessing in disguise. It was a massive blessing in disguise because in 2002, I probably only had about 50 hours and I wasn't as mature. 2005, I was 25. 1,000 hours. I knew what I wanted. So I was very, very dedicated to naval aviation and getting jets at the time. So primary training was in the T-34 mentor. Honestly, it was very easy for me because I had 1,000 hours. They're not teaching you how to land or to take off. And so I was actually put on an accelerated program. I finished up very quickly and was able to get grades to select jets out of Kingsville. And Kingsville is where my work began, because where everyone else knew where their learning curve was through naval aviation, I got into a fighter jet or a fighter jet trainer, a T-45 Goshawk, and I'd never flown a jet. I'd really never flown formation. I'd never gone at those speeds. And so now my learning curve went from well above average to right at average. And I was working as hard, if not harder, than a lot of people, because I was trying to relearn some of the ways that naval aviation does things, vice, you know, the way the civilian world does things. And so Kingsville was tough for me. I was able to honestly graduate and have above average grades in order to select Super Hornets at the time. But the T-45 kicked my butt in a lot of areas, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun flying.
Did you go to the boat in the T-45 for the first time?
I did. So you always qualify daytime, or I think it's different now. But you always qualify daytime in the T-45. And then once you go to your weapon system, or for me, the F-18 Super Hornet, you qualify day and night. So I went out to the boat for the first time as a T-45 student, and I'll never forget. You're holding overhead for almost an hour before they call you down to land. And I mean, your heart is racing, racing. And my very first pass at the boat, it couldn't have been more beautiful until the very end. It's, you know, that old pride comes before a fall. Around the corner, I line up. Lineup's really good. The wake is tucked between my left armpit, which is how we really do line up at the boat for a lot of times. And right in close, there's something called a burble, which is disturbed air that falls off the back end of the boat, depending on how fast the boat is moving, how much wind it's having to create. And they warn you about it all the time. You're going to have to add power as you go through the burble. Well, probably come before a fall, I'm like, man, I've got this railed. And all of a sudden, I just hear screaming power calls from the LSOs. It's like, power, power, power. And I land. I wound up catching the one wire, which is not good. But I remember rolling out and thinking to myself, that couldn't have gone any worse. Couldn't have gone any worse. I didn't get waved off. But I don't know if my heart, other than combat, has beat that hard in my life. I mean, it was exhilarating, but it was terrifying at the same time. And it was daytime flying. So, yeah, that was my first trap on the boat.
Didn't they put heart rate monitors on guys in Vietnam and their heart rate was lower operating, you know, flying combat sorties over Vietnam than coming back to the boat? I don't know if that's a true story or not, but
I've heard the same thing. Flight physiology in the Navy would tell you the same thing. But I can tell you that some of the most terrifying moments I've ever had was behind the boat at night when it's pitching deck and it's raining and everything else. I mean, you know, every bit as much as combat, I would say like a night strafe run in combat, that's about where your heart rate would be.
Okay.
So.
It sounds terrible to me, but you know.
That's just me. It's a funny story. I'll segue with this, but when I was going through MQT and the F-16, I just got done with, you know, 13 years in the Navy and 2,500 hours or whatever. And I was going out for my MQT or my mission qualification check ride. And the ceilings were like 800 overcast. And I just got done, you know, landing at the boat and all these things for 14 years. And I'll never forget, my lead takes off and they're like, hey, pyro up, it's 800 feet overcast. And at the time, I don't know if it's still the same, I had to have 1,000 feet of the clouds. So okay. I was thinking my buddy was going to just simply say, hey, it's 1,000 feet, pyro up, you're good to take off. They sent me back, they canceled the entire sortie, sent me back to the chocks. And I had to do my whole MQT ride over again. I'm sitting there thinking to myself, man, it's 800. That's really high. You know, the ceilings are really high, but I don't know. It was more funny than anything else.
Well, that's, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, like the Navy, because we have categories, right? You know, 1,000, I think 800, 300. That's usually where it stops. You're never like down to men's, even as an instructor pilot, unless it's waiver. You know, there's a waiver, OG waiver. It's a big deal. But the Navy doesn't do that. I don't think.
No, they don't.
Maybe just, I mean, the men's are the men's.
The men's are 0-0. I've got a great HUD footage of one of my buddies landing in 0-0 at the boat. Absolutely terrifying. I was actually a landing signals officer I wasn't on the microphone at the time, but I was in the back backing up the LSOs with the deck. And yeah, the men's are 0-0, you know, and if you have to land, it's either land or reject in some scenarios, if you're in blue water ops and whatnot. But I'll have to share that with you sometime. I'll have to email it over. But that HUD footage, you know, he lands, a couple of my buddies landed, and I mean, you don't see anything. You know, you don't see a thing. You're just listening to the landing signals officers giving you guidance on power or lineup. And you're obeying what they tell you. You're trusting with your life. So,
ugh. Yeah, I would love to see that. I've seen some of the footage, like on the deck. You know, the wind's whipping. There's no visibility. You're looking down final LSOs or on the radio talking. There's no jet. And then last split second is F-18 just slams into the deck and catches a wire. And you're like, nah. I have no desire.
A shout out to O-Town O'Connor. And Bender is one of my best friends. Bender Alexander, but both of those guys landed in 0-0 conditions. It was basically a typhoon. I've never seen anything like it. I'll share it with you, and you'll kind of see from the heads up display what they were looking at. It's incredible.
Yeah, a whole bunch of nope thanks. But when you have no other options, I mean, there's no plan B. Be a champion, do that or eject.
That's right.
Know? So, ooh. How does that, I mean, how does that work with the 0-0? Is that tied to the magic carpet with the F-18 and be able to bring it down? Or is the LSO, you know, even though it's 0-0 in the cockpit or you're not able to see, is the LSO able to see the landing light? Or how is that actually working? How is he giving the guidance?
So the magic carpet came online a little bit after I left. So I was never able to fly Magic Carpet. One of my good buddies got a launch pad, I think helped quite a bit with the makeup of Magic Carpet. So it makes it much easier now for F-18s and F-35s to land on the boat. But we didn't have that. So at the time, honestly, it's the LSOs would always say landing lights on. And they are so trained and they're so precise on the pitch attitude, the sounds, and the power application that they would talk you down. And you would listen to their commands all the way down. We did have a system called ACLS or Automatic Carrier Landing System that you could couple to, and it would land you on the boat automatically, kind of like a Cat 1 in a 7.5 and 7.6. But there was a restrictions based on waves, height, and roll and pitch and whatnot, that if you're ever in a storm, ACLS wasn't reliable enough, so everything was hand flown for the most part. But I have heard, I've never got to fly, but for my buddies, the magic carpet is amazing. It helps out tremendously.
Yeah, they're not having to walk uphill both ways in the snow to school anymore. It's easy.
That's right. When carriers were made out of wood and not iron.
Well, I've talked to a couple of guys too on the podcast about it. The aspect that I never really thought about, I know obviously you got the pitching deck and stuff, but even like a clear VFR day with a pitching deck, guys coming up initial and into the break, the timing of it really matters. But the LSO being able to time the pitch in the deck with the rollout and obviously the distance, things like that, and it's critical, right? Because if you got a 10-foot swing or waves, the landing area is going to drop 10 feet or rise 10 feet, which could either slam into the back of the boat or just drop away. I guess I should have thought about that. But again, that also just adds to how terrible this whole thing sounds.
You would have enjoyed it.
Yeah. I want to do one catch shot. I want out, and then I don't need to land back on that thing. I know I'm trapped at sea with 5,000 guys. Like, I'm ready to go back to shore, but I want to do the cat shot.
That's right. I always said carrier life was practicing to be in prison. So, you know, you got a little bit better quarters, this and that, but if you can survive 8 or 10 months on a boat, then you could probably survive prison for a little bit. So
I would believe that. The Navy LNO that sat next to me when I was at the Kayak doing my short LNO tour there, he was the happiest person on earth. We were all mad and angry because we're missing the fight for 2 weeks or whatever it was. And he was like, man, I got Wi-Fi, got my own bunk. Life is great. I'm like, I guess it's all about perspective, you know?
It's all perspective.
Oh, well, talk to me through those first couple years as an F-18 pilot. What was that like? Because it eventually leads to going to Top Gun and some deployments. But what were the first few years flying the Super Hornet?
Sure. I wound up selecting, like, out of Kingsville, like I said, the F-18 Super Hornet. And wound up going out to Lemoore, California. There's two master jet bases for the Navy at that time in the contiguous 48 states. One's in Lemoore, California. The other one's in Oceana or Virginia Beach, NAS Oceana. So I was sent out to Lemoore, California, and I went through the squadron, which is called VFA-122, which is the RAG or the training squadron for the F-18 Super Hornet. And out of that, you can select, there's two variants of the Super Hornet. There's the F-18E or Echo, which is a single seat version of the F-18 Super Hornet. And then you have the F-18F or Foxtrot, which is the two seat version, which has a pilot and both a weapon systems operator in the back. And so based on grades, based on competitiveness, based on the needs of the Navy, I was put into F-18E or Echo as a single seat pilot. Graduated, went to the boat and qualified both day and night, and then was assigned to VFA-147, the Argonauts, which is a Lemoore-based squadron as well. And so that was kind of the process through my training for the Super Hornet. I'll say the qualifications at night, which we've already hit on a little bit, was even more intense and more terrifying than my first day trap. My first cat shot, I'll never forget. I walked out, it's storming. I'm like, I'm a student. Shouldn't we have, you know, better weather out here? And they're like, no. They taxed them in the cat, and they shot me off the catapult. And I had the very worst case of vertigo I've ever had in my life. My entire world tilted 90 degrees. And the only way that I could get through is put my pilot relief modes on and trust my autopilot. Wound up climbing up, and you go to holding. You hold for about 20 minutes to calm down before they bring you back in for your first night landing. But I've never, ever felt that vertigo before in my life, where my entire spatial awareness was tilted 90 degrees. So at one point, I was literally tilting my head 90 degrees to the left so I could look at my heads-up display and make sure it felt like I was right side up. But I was able to qualify the first time at the boat for the day and night. And then I went off to VFA-147, which was my first operational tour for a 3-year stint.
I want to talk about the qualification period, but before I do that, the vertigo piece is something interesting and absolutely terrifying. For me, anytime I was on the wing of the tanker, if you're like VFR and then you hit the weather, I'm in 90 degrees of bank. By the time I got more and more experienced, one thing I would recognize too is like you start climbing, right? Yes. On the wing of the tanker, which gives given the illusion that you're in the turn. But in the Air Force, I'm sure the Navy does it as well. So one of the demos you do in training is you start a slow, like 15, 20 degree bank spiral turn, and the student has eyes closed. And you're going to do that, let all the fluid in the inner ear stabilize, and at some point, the instructor is just going to bump the stick in the other direction. It's going to throw the fluid off, and you're going to think you're turning, have the student look. But that is something that's real. Again, shooting off the end of the boat, going from zero to, I don't know, 160 knots, I don't know how fast you're going there, but that's got to, I would imagine that's the factor, the contributing factor, main contributing factor, what causes that vertigo, or what was it?
It is. It's the instant acceleration from zero to, you nailed it, about 160 knots off the front end. And it throws your head back. And then when you actually are at the end of the catapult stroke, it throws your head forward. So you have vertigo that sets in where your body thinks that you're pitching too far up. And then when it throws your head forward, it feels like you're pitching down. And so there's actually been a lot of naval aviators that have been lost to thinking that their pitch is too high and pushing over in order to arrest that rate of ascent. But what winds up happening is there's only 70 feet between the water and the top of the deck. of where you're going off, about 70, 75 feet, if I remember properly. So it's a second. It's a heartbeat. It's not even a heartbeat. It's literally, if I bunt forward or if I push the stick forward, I'm in the water. And so, you know, just like the Air Force trained you, we're trained to fight that vertigo, not trust our inner ears and trust our instruments. And so honestly, in that night, it's what saved me, because I've never, to this day, in the darkest of nights, I've never felt vertigo like that. That first catapult shot was, it was crazy. It was eerie.
Yeah, that's a cough and you're into the water. What, I assume the HUD flight path marker, you know, to me, I just envision that thing shaking like crazy as you're going off the end of the boat. But once you're off the end of the shot, I mean, is it right there? That's what you're looking at? Or are you looking at a attitude indicator, a standby or something like that? That what's the procedure there?
So the you're absolutely right. The catapult stroke, we call it a velocity vector, but it's the same thing as a flight path vector or flight path marker. But our velocity vector is what we're looking at. We're looking directly through the HUD, and we're evaluating our acceleration to make sure that our acceleration is proper, and then our end speed. So, you know, whatever we've calculated, if it's 160 knots, we've gotten to 160 knots prior to going off the end of the ship. And then from there, we're evaluating our altitude to see if we lose it. And if not, we have a procedure, that emergency procedure that's memorized, boldface, our memory items that we would have to do in just a heartbeat in order to save ourselves. You know, if we start sinking into the water, if we don't have the airspeed, if we're not gaining the altitude that we need, we would do what we call emergency catapult flyaway. And it would just be a memory item.
This is going to be an Air Force recruiting team before we're all said and done here. But a low energy cat shot, that's a thing as well. Is that a frequent, and I know it's not frequent, have you ever experienced it or heard that with, you know, I guess the catapult's not primed right, or there's some kind of malfunction, and then that jet's going off the end, but not with enough energy to get it going?
I have. I've never really experienced it myself. The F-18 Super Hornet, though, is able to be configured as a tanker as well. So we can do organic tanking within the carrier strike group, which is great. It's a very has a ton of utility as far as being a tanker. But every time it's loaded down with a five wet, we call it five wet or a tanker configuration, as you come off the end of the boat, you don't accelerate because you're so heavy. You sink just maybe a little bit, and you have that feeling of, oh my goodness, is it going to climb away? Is it not every single time? But I've never had a soft shot. I've never had experienced a true soft shot, but there are people that have had soft catapult shots and have had to go right into that emergency procedure that I was talking about. And it's either saved their life or they've lost their life. So.
Yeah, no unforgiving environment, to say the least. So that was the other question I wanted to talk about, which was going to qualify. So you're going through the rag, you're training. I imagine there's some period that, hey, you have a minimum number of hours in the syllabus that if there's a carrier off the coast, you can go out and qualify day and night. But that might be later in the syllabus. That might be in the middle of the syllabus. How does that work? And what happens if, I mean, do guys not qualify? And then what happens?
Now it's a great question. It typically comes, it can come more in the middle or to the later end of the syllabus. It never comes at the beginning of the syllabus. They always try to get, I believe it's probably, and don't take this to the bank, probably 60, 70, 80 hours in the F-18 before you go to the aircraft carrier. And you're paired up with a mentor, a landing signals officer. These are landing signals officers that have already been through their initial sea tour, their instructors at the RAG or the readiness air group, and they specialize in being a landing signals officer. And so they will take you to the boat the first time, and typically you have to do, I believe it's 10 and 10. So you have to do 10 traps in the daytime, 10 traps at night. There's a couple of touch and goes that are filtered in there as well, but everything's graded. You know, it's interesting about the boat. Someone told me once that every time you go to the boat, your your job, your reputation, and your life are on the line every single time. And it's very true because everyone's watching you. And you can get away with a bad pass one time, but if you're a senior guy and you have two bad passes, people start asking the question, hey, what's going on in his life? You know, what's going on? But you qualify via GPA, so the LSO is great every pass, and there are inevitably people that don't make it every single boat. I believe there was two or three that did not make it the first time I went to the boat at nighttime in the Super Hornet. One of them was one of my best friends and wound up turning out to be one of the best aviators around the boat I've ever seen. His name was Yogel. I'll just use his call sign as Yogel. But he was one of the best naval aviators, best landing signals officers I've ever seen. I think that probably lit a fire under him because it's just demanding. You know, it's very demanding. He was one of the best. But there are people that fail every single time they go to the boat. So.
Yeah, I guess then you just have to wait for the next cycle to go back out and do it, or onto something else.
It depends on how bad it is. You typically will always get a second chance. And again, I was never a rag LSO, but a lot of my friends were. And you typically always get a second chance, unless there are a lot of safety of flights, like really scary things that happened. But you only get two chances. And, you know, you could have gone through 2 years of very intense training, showed up for the first time to qualify at night at the boat. You fail, you go back one more time. If you fail again, your career is done as a fighter pilot. You know, they transition you to another airframe.
Gotcha. The Argonauts, that's your first fighter squadron outside the RAG, correct?
It is, yes.
And you do two deployments, 2009, 2010 timeframe, if I'm reading correctly?
We did. 2009, we did a six-month deployment over to Asia at the time. China scenarios, North Korea scenarios. It was more of what we called a booze cruise. We got to see a lot of Asia. You know, we got to get off the boat quite a bit, enjoy it. It's not really the type of deployment that you want if you want to be a warfighter, but it was really interesting. It was cool to see the operations over there. That was a 6 to 7 month deployment. And then we wound up doing a mini deployment. It was about 3 months in 2010. During that time frame, it was weird. The Navy had more fighter squadrons than they did. Let me take that back. They had more aircraft carriers than they had fighter squadrons. And so you're typically attached to one aircraft carrier. But during my tour, my first deployment was on the John C. Stennis. And then after that, they moved us over to the Ronald Reagan, which were both West Coast based carriers. But they moved us over there because the boats are on a cycle. The air crew are not on a cycle. So we wound up doing another 2 to 3 month deployment in 2010 as well. And that was over to the Pacific Theater as well.
Okay. And then next kind of step for you is going to Top Gun. Can you talk to me about that?
Sure. There's an application process like anything else. I know that you know this as well, but your reputation is really what drives a lot of the a lot of the options that you'll have coming out of your first fleet squadron. And so in the Navy, there's really three programs that are, I would say, maybe four programs that are specialized. One would be test pilot school to apply for. Another, you could apply for the Blue Angels, which is very selective. Another is Top Gun, which is the tactical experts. And then you could go be a landing signals officer and specialize in that at one of the RTUs or RAGs. And so through that process, there's an application process. You have to go typically and do a rush ride. So you go and do a flight with one of the, they call them bros or Top Gun instructors, or a weapons school instructor, and they grade you. People write letters of recommendation for you based on your ability and your character, and then it goes in front of a selection process, and which is pretty unique selection process. I won't get too far into how we do it, but we take a look at the whole person. We have multiple angles from different views of people based on character and ability. They rank you based on where they think you fall out within the list, and then you're either selected to go with 10 top gun or not. And I was very fortunate to be selected in 2010 to attend Top Gun in 2011.
Do you go back to a fighter squadron after that, or do you go? Did you stay and become a Top Gun instructor following that?
So it's a little bit different in the Navy. Once you graduate from Top Gun, Top Gun is about a, I would say, 12 to 13 week course, and it specializes in unit level tactics with some large force exercise or large force strike type capability at the end. It's extremely intense. We can get into that a little bit later. But from there, you are already assigned to a place. So a lot of people believe that it's a competition to become a Top Gun instructor or weapons school instructor. It's a little bit different. From my understanding, the Air Force has the Air Force Weapons School, which is the equivalent of Top Gun. In the Navy, we have Top Gun, which is in Fallon, Nevada, and that trains the instructors to be instructors, and it also does a ton of tactical development, evaluation and development. From there, you can be assigned to a couple other places. You can either stay on once you graduate as a Top Gun instructor, or you can go to one of the weapons schools. So a West Coast weapons school would be in Lemoore, California. The East Coast weapons school would be in NAS Oceana. And then we also put some Top Gun instructors at each one of the RTUs to standardize the rags. And also we put it with our operational test squadron, VX-9, in order to be a liaison. So even before I went to Top Gun, they had assigned me to the West Coast Weapons School, which is in Lemoore, California. So I did a 3-year instructional tour. And the difference between Top Gun and one of the weapons schools or the West Coast Weapons School is we standardize the fleet. So everything that they put out, we do all the check rides for everyone that's going out to combat. We run something that's called Strike Fighter Advanced Readiness Program that we grade all the squadrons prior to them going out to combat. We make sure that they're standardized within what Top Gun is putting out. So I wound up, after graduation, going back and being a West Coast Weapons School instructor.
Okay. Yeah, because I think probably just a little bit different than the Air Force. I was wondering if you did any kind of integration with the Air Force Weapons School while you were at the Weapons School, Top Gun Weapons School, at 3-year assignment we're talking about. Because, again, we're throwing, you know, some terms that are synonymous and then slightly different amongst others. Did you do any kind of integration between Air Force Weapons School and Top Gun?
Are you a passionate aviation enthusiast? Then you'll be thrilled to hear about our sponsor, Air Corps Aviation. This exciting company has been revolutionizing the aviation industry since 2008, and they have some amazing career opportunities available. More about that in just a minute. Air Corps Aviation is at the forefront of airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating all the way back to World War II. Their dedicated team is involved in various aspects of aerospace, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, using state-of-the-art technology. Their exceptional expertise in core manufacturing capabilities like metal forming, CNC machining, and complete aircraft rebuilding has led to the restoration of some award-winning aircraft, such as a couple P-51s, such as P-51 Thunderbird, Twilight Tier, and Sierra Sioux 2. And if you've been following me for a while, you might remember I was fortunate enough to fly over the Super Bowl in 2018 in Minneapolis. The formation was led by Sierra Sioux 2 alongside two A-10s and myself in the F-16, so this is a very cool full-circle experience. These incredible achievements have captured the attention of aircraft owners, aviation enthusiasts, and the general public alike. If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation, then Air Corps Aviation is the perfect place for you. They are rapidly expanding their team in 2024 and have job openings in departments such as engineering and CAD, quality assurance, fabrication, and restoration. This is your chance to turn a passion into profession. Air Corps Aviation is offering some amazing benefits for full-time positions, including health insurance, PTO, HSA, retirement plans, life insurance, and the extra perk of enjoying Fridays off. If you're ready to be part of a team dedicated to fulfilling the dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircorpsaviation.com/careers today and take the first step towards an exciting career in aviation. Again, that's aircorpsaviation.com/careers. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
We did. Yes, we did. We would always go down and we would integrate with a lot of their large force exercises, especially at the time we were trying to figure out the integration between fifth generation aircraft or the F-22 and how we integrated in Super Hornet, so fourth generation in, and how to best fight the fight with the Raptor and the Super Hornet, because we knew that the F-35 was coming online. So we would routinely go out to Nellis to do large force exercises. We always had a Air Force Weapons School graduate on staff at Top Gun as well. I believe the instructor that was there at the time was a guy named call sign Hobbs. I think his last name was Crofton. He was a Top Gun instructor. That was an Air Force Weapons graduate, Weapons School graduate. So there was always a lot of integration between Top Gun, the Weapons Schools, and the Air Force Weapons School out of Nellis.
Fun story. I did put Hobbs in the backseat for a demo practice, so you got to experience that. There's some good GoPro footage somewhere on his computer.
That's awesome. Around it,
yeah. 9+ G's multiple times. Yeah, because for the Air Force, there's a weapon school pretty much for every weapon system, you know, F-16, F-22, C-17, space, cyber, RPAs, et cetera. Does the Navy, so we have the F-18, do any of the other aircraft, or does like space or cyber SWOs, do they have a weapon school, like where there's any kind of integration, or is that done a little differently?
I think it's done a little bit differently. So again, when I was in the fleet, the F-18 was the only fighter really online. The F-35 was coming on. And so when you say Top Gun, you can either go through the Top Gun course as an F-35 or an F-18 pilot. And the course has maybe changed a little bit. So I'm talking a little bit of dated information, but Top Gun is Top Gun. And that's it. Some of the other, I would say, jobs have what they consider centers of excellence, but they don't have weapon schools that I'm aware of. Okay. I will say this to this day, Top Gun was the most professional place, the most excellent place I've ever been. It was an incredible experience, and the instructors were the best in the world, and no one lowered the bar for anybody. It was an amazing experience.
And during that time period, you're the subject matter expert for the Super Hornet. So I guess everything is flowing through you working with Top Gun, et cetera, in that time period. Can you talk to me about your time there at Top Gun?
Sure. So when I was at the weapons school, the West Coast Weapons School, I was assigned to be the combat systems subject matter expert. So typically, if you're at Top Gun or one of the weapons schools, you're going to go through a process called murder boarding, and you're assigned a subject. It's typically a 6 to 8 month process of becoming a professional public speaker and giving a presentation based on your subject matter expert. And for mine, it was combat systems. So combat systems included Link 16 or a lot of the intelligence gathering capabilities. So for us, we had MIDS, which was the Link 16 conduit there. And for people that don't know what Link 16 is, just think about it as the high speed internet in the air that passes information in between fighters. Also all of the, again, intelligence gathering capabilities on the F-18 was my subject matter expert. So I gave a 3-hour lecture, that at the time had to be completely memorized, which is incredible because, again, I graduated with that 2.9 GPA. I still blows my mind. I was able to memorize 3 hours of information without looking at slides whatsoever and just sit down and start talking about it. That was my subject matter expert, and I taught it, and I standardized. Basically, my job was to standardize the fleet on that area.
And in that time period too, that led to some interesting, I think, liaison opportunities. Is that correct?
It did. So, you know, a couple of the really cool opportunities that I had at the weapons school was I was able to join the F-35 team. So I went down to Lockheed Martin and got a peek behind the curtain with how the Top Gun was building the initial tactics for the F-35 to integrate into naval aviation. So that was really cool. Another really great opportunity that I had was at the time, United States Naval Warfare Development Group was standing up a light attack program, and they were bringing in Link 16 capabilities to some of those aircraft. And so I was able to go over there and work kind of hand in hand for probably about a year and a half to 2 years with that organization, which was amazing to see behind the curtain on that organization as well. But, you know, at the time I didn't even understand that they had aviation assets, but they do. It's an incredible organization, and just the small peek behind the curtain that I got to see how they did business and what level of excellence they brought was amazing as well.
Yeah, it'd be fun to talk about that more, but I think we'll just skip on past that. But yeah, some unique opportunities. You wrap up your tour at the weapons school, and then 2015, 2016, you're deploying on the Harry S. Truman for Operation Inherent Resolve. Seemed like a busy deployment just looking at some of the stats there. What was it like for you guys?
It was one of the most rewarding and also one of the most challenging deployments I ever did. You know, leading up to this deployment was the rise of ISIS, or the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Levant, however you wanted to say it. And so Operation Inherent Resolve was obviously we were tasked with destroying, disrupting their operations, but it was busy. We did an entire workup cycle, which is about 10 months. So I joined, so backing up a little bit, after I left the weapons school, I was assigned to VFA 103, the Jolly Rogers, which were based out of NAS Oceania in Virginia Beach. So I joined them as their training officer. In Air Force speak, it would be weapons officer. And I basically was in charge of all the tactical training that took place within that squadron. I had a cohort, so another transition for me was I had been for 10 years a single seat pilot, and the squadron, which was VFA 103, was a two seat squadron. So I went from flying by myself to flying with a weapons systems officer, which had a training officer to train those guys as well. One of my best friends is a guy named Chupa Gorski, that was my training officer, and then another guy, you may need to edit this, but his call sign was Raw Dog. I'll just leave it at that. But he was they were amazing. They were both Top Gun instructors, amazing tacticians. But I was able to join them, and we were able to do an entire workup process with our young guys prior to going over to Operation Inherent Resolve. But when we showed up in theater, it was from night one in theater, it was 8 months of really solid combat.
The you know, that time period, which, I mean, it was going up until, I think, 2018, was just so busy. But, you know, when we showed up in 2014, our squadron dropped the most precision-guided weapons of any F-16 unit. But then the next unit beat it, and then the next unit beat it, and then the next unit beat it. Just kept escalating and escalating and escalating. Driving in from the boat, how far was it typically just to get into theater just to start working?
It's a great question. Depending on whether you were going to Iraq and Syria, I believe it was about an hour and a half to 2 hour flight. And that was to get into the edge of Syria. So typically we would hit a tanker on the front side, which was an organic F-18. And then we would hit a KC-135 before we showed up for our first vol or our first tasking within a kill box. But anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours is what we would fly before we would actually get on station in order to do our job.
Is there anything that in that deployment in particular, like a combat mission, a sortie that stands out in your mind?
There's so many of them. There's one that sticks out in my mind quite a bit. And some of my buddies will laugh at me for this, but it was an incredible mission. So much like the Air Force, we do large force exercises, but up until this point, we'd never really done deliberate strike, like large force deliberate strike. And so prior to the deployment, we do about an 8-month workup process. And during that time, I'd gotten my large force strike lead qualification. I was the senior training officer within the carrier at that time. And so they allowed me the ability to get this qualification, which is probably the highest tactical qualification that you can get inside or outside of Top Gun or the weapon schools. So we had gone almost 6 months with combat. All these other strike leads had gotten strikes, you know, that put their name on it. But because I was a junior guy, I hadn't gotten anything. And so I was kind of chomping at the bit to go do something. And so I probably threw a fit to the wrong person. But I was like, hey, listen, you asked me to get this qualification. I put a lot of work in. I would like to do one of these. And so they wound up allowing me to do one. So I'm going to rewind a little bit. But the first month when we showed up on station was different than any deployment I'd ever been on before. I'll never forget the first month we were in deployment. There was an incident that happened up in Mosul, Iraq. And what wound up happening was there was a lot of ethnic cleansing that was going on with Yazidis and Coptic Christians and Shia Muslims up there in Mosul by ISIS. And there was one incident that stuck in my brain that was over 100 women and children were brought out to the road. They were laid down on the road by ISIS, and there was literally a steamroller that rolled over every single one of them, wound up killing over 100 women and children. And that really changed my view on a lot of things as far as who we were hunting and who we were killing. And so fast forward to June timeframe, it was around June 7th to June 8th. I'd finally thrown a big enough fit that they gave me this, they wanted to pacify me. So they gave me this little strike with like two other aircraft, and we were going to go do a deliberate strike against a weapons facility that was north of Fallujah. It was an IED making plant or whatever. So it was my XO, a guy named Omed, that was a weapons systems officer in my backseat. For those that don't know, executive officers would be like an Air Force DO, would be kind of the equivalent, but they're second in charge of the squadron. He was a very close friend of mine. He was phenomenal in the jet. And then we had two young VFA 103 JOs on my wing. One of the pilots is a guy named Kupachansky, who wound up becoming a Blue Angel. And then in his backseat was a guy named Gooch. Kevin Grosh is his name. They were both fantastic. So I was still a little sour grapes because they gave me a deliberate strike, but it was a two-plane, you know, we're going to drop on these targets and be done. And they had checked their box and pacified me. So we went out, we dropped weapons, we destroyed the two targets. And then my XO was like, hey, we should call up and see if there's any other tasking that's available. And we had a nickname for him. We called him the Bomb Whisperer, because every time you had Omed in your backseat, I mean, you would get into action. I mean, he was like a hunting dog, a hound dog, and finding action. So we got on the radio, and all of a sudden we hear a transmission come in saying, hey, we need any fire support you can up in Mosul as fast as possible. So, of course, Omed rogered it up. He said, we're there, and we plugged in blower or afterburner, and I mean, we were streaking as fast as we could. We're trying to be there for us to take in the strike. And so what we realized with this mission was it was a little bit different. It was different the fact that there was communication that was going on that was different. It wasn't a standard Joint Terminal Air Controller or JTAC communications. There was a lot of comm coming in from a lot of different agencies. And so we were listening, and we were trying to build the picture of what was going on in Mosul that was that critical for us to get to. And so, I guess, hand of providence, we show up overhead Mosul, and we were the first persons there, so we were assigned to the mission. And so we get to work on trying to identify the building that they wanted taken down. And Mosul is kind of like downtown Louisville, you know, maybe not Chicago, but it's a huge city. It's a massive city. There's a lot of population that's in there, and there's a really dense portion of buildings that were there that they wanted us to take out a certain one. And not only did they want us to drop on this building, but they wanted us to drop on the northeast side of the building. They basically wanted these bombs on the side to minimize collateral damage and for the building to collapse in on itself and kill the inhabitants in there. And so they were going through their, you know, their patterns of life. They're going through collateral damage estimates, everything that you talked about. And typically tactically would set up in a wheel. And the terminology over there, which you're probably familiar with, was strike posture set. And so we would call when we were strike posture set, and all of a sudden the JTAC came up and said, hey, you've been cleared for an immediate push. You have basically a 15-second window to get bombs off because the area is clear. We still didn't know what we were up against. So we turn inbound. We accelerate probably about 15,000 feet. And both my wingman and myself, we drop two JDAMs. We take the building down. It collapses on itself. We see a couple squirters, or people that escaped from the building, but I think there was a total of 9 in there, and we only saw 2 people escape. And then there were some special operations that cleaned those folks up. So there was a ton of excitement on the radio. We still didn't know what had happened. We went and got some gas. We returned to the Harry S. Truman, and we went into intelligence. We call it Civic, but our intelligence center is where we debrief. And a lot of cheering going on, a lot of high-fiving going on. And we were like, what do we do? You know, we still had no clue what we did. We were excited. It was pure luck that we were there. But at the time, which was very satisfying to me, they were actually the head of ISIS in the Nineveh province in Mosul was having a Ramadan breakfast. And he was the person who was responsible for commanding the execution of those 100 people in the first month. And we wound up, you know, getting him, his wife, and 5 or 6 other HVIs or high value individuals that were in that building. And it wound up cutting down on a lot of, I would say it didn't solve a lot, but it wound up cutting down for at least a few weeks on the violence that was in that region. But it was amazing to, again, go back and see some vindication for what he had commanded 5 months earlier. And we wound up getting pure luck. But we're in the right place in the right time, and I'll take it.
Yeah, this is a terrible way to describe it, but like, what a weird time and experience. The deliberate strike piece, I think, again, for those listening, for Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, if you're flying a fighter, you're typically going up, you're going to support a vulnerability period, and you're going to go work for a JTAC and do something in a region, just kind of ready to respond, airborne response, more or less. The deliberate strike piece, yeah, it's obviously happened in other wars, but it was very prevalent in Operation Inherent Resolve, where you mission plan it, you take off knowing you're going to go hit these targets. It might be with 18 other jets, it might be with 2 other jets. Knock that out, and then if you got bombs left in your jet like you did, you're going to go roam around and be available if the call comes. But that would be a very rewarding and satisfying piece, because seeing the just heinous things that ISIS did, they were subhuman, eradicating them from the face of the earth. A very noble thing, in my opinion. So,
yeah, absolutely. A lot of people, you know, well, there's been some people that have asked me how I feel about it. I said, well, that's one mission, but to tell you the truth, this sounds really harsh. It was different in Afghanistan, the fact that some of those young people were just getting paid by the Taliban and they didn't know what was going on. But if you're a part of ISIS, like you were saying, you were subhuman, and I could go home and eat a cheeseburger and be completely fine. Yep. And the fact that we were just, and what we were doing was just.
Yep. Zero sleep loss over any of that stuff, because the things they would do, subhuman. They don't deserve to walk the earth, in my opinion. But
green.
Digress. That wraps up your time in the Navy, that deployment pretty much, right?
It did. It sure did. Yeah. In fact, the very last flight that I did was with one of my best friends, Raw Dog. We flew off. We had a fly from the carrier, and we landed in Oceania. All of our family was out there. It was a pretty emotional time for me in my life, too. You know, a week prior to this deployment, I lost my mother to breast cancer. And so we buried her. And then 2 days later, I was out on an 8-month deployment. And 2 months prior to losing my mother, we had had our first daughter, Caroline. And so I hadn't seen her in probably close to a year. And so coming back from there, I'll never forget the wave of emotions. We're flying back. We see the coast. One of my best friends is in our back seat. We land, get to hug my family, see my two boys, my daughter, Caroline. And 2 weeks later, that was my last flight in the Navy. 2 weeks later, I was heading to South Carolina in order to join the South Carolina Air National Guard.
Man, that had to be a lot of emotion and that's a lot of jostling. I thought getting out of active duty, that was the toughest transition that I've experienced in my life, which I guess is a blessing if that's the toughest thing I've experienced as far as a transition goes. But it's a very weird time. There's a lot of unknowns that you're jostling and trying to figure out as you're going through that. Then factor in all the things you had to deal with. Young daughter, again, my oldest was born while I was deployed. That was a suboptimal thing, but it definitely has a lot of emotions when you come back. But I can't imagine being basically gone. And you got a 1-year-old, very different child. Mother passed away, and then separating from the Navy. How'd you manage all that? How'd you juggle? Was it tough?
Yeah, I didn't juggle it well. I didn't. You know, for a long period of time, I didn't. That's a long conversation that we can have or not have. But when I was transitioning out of the Navy, I had not dealt with the death of my mother. I had not dealt with 8 months of combat. I came home for 2 weeks. I immediately left another 6 months to go out to Tucson, Arizona, for the F-16 transition course. And then after that, I went right into UPS training. So for about 20 out of 24 months, I was gone from my family. And, you know, we're, as fighter pilots, people that want to push through, we're unstoppable, we're unbreakable. But you pile that much stress on, and honestly, to tell you the truth, I didn't deal with it well. There's a lot of things I would have done differently, but it was the toughest transition that I've ever had. You know, both, I would say, spiritually, mentally, physically, everything else. So there's a lot there.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to dig into that. I think that's one thing that I told my buddies who were behind me getting out. And again, I wasn't dealing with all – that was a lot of vacancy or a lot of wait time, which – that would just amplified the transition for me for sure. But it's like fence in, it's not easy, even if everything is like dialed in and you know what the next job's going to be. There's still a lot of factors that are going into it. So every situation is different, but nonetheless, you're making a big life change and a big cultural shift from what you really in your formidable years in your early career are used to. So I think it's good to talk about.
Yeah, it's also like, I've always thought this, like fighter pilots are very tribal, you know, and the Navy fighter pilot community is, I can't say this for active duty Air Force, we are very tight as squadrons. There's only 18 pilots, and if you're in a 2C squadron, 18 whistles, so 36 people total. My first 10 years, there was only 18 pilots in my squadrons, and so you are brothers. Your families do life together. And when you're going through all of that and you lose your tribe, although it was my choice to join the Air National Guard, when you lose your tribe, you don't know what that actually means to you. You lose those people that you can go talk to about, you know, situations in your life or whatever else that you trust with your life. And although the Air Force brother and I wanted to make some incredible friends there, the Air National Guard, because there are a lot of part-time pilots, there are some full-time pilots, it's just not as close-knit a group. There's just a lot more people in the squadron. I think we had 55 or 60 pilots at one time, and so I thought the cultures would be similar, but the cultures were radically different, and so that was tough on me as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Air Force Active Duty Fighter Squadron, you get that tight-knit bond. I've never been in the guard or the reserve, but I can appreciate, and a fighter squadron that is, but I can appreciate everyone has kind of, for the most part, another thing is the primary source. There's obviously some full timers in there, but you're just staying proficient enough that if the flag goes up, you can knock off the rust and go back to it. But everyone's kind of doing their own thing. Again, I haven't lived it, but that's my perception. So I could see that being a challenge for sure.
It is.
The transition to the F-16, obviously, you know, it was ready to get back into the single seat. I get it. And you're just aspiring to fly again, the greatest fighter ever made. How was it going to the F-16 from the F-18? How was it kind of learning the seed mission? Because I imagine the Super Hornet, you weren't really focused a lot on seed. How was that for you?
Again, to be honest, I mean, it was difficult. The actual flying of the F-16 was amazing. It is an amazing performing airplane, has amazing capabilities. But I gone from, you know, really being at the very peak of my career. The F-18 Super Hornet was just an extension of my body. It was an extension of my thought process. I didn't think about it. I just knew how to react, you know. I was very, very proficient at the time to go into the F-16. And I always tell people the F-16 and the F-18, they fly completely differently. Like the F-18, all the strengths of the F-18 are the F-16's weaknesses. And all the strengths of the F-16 are the F-18's weaknesses. And so where, as an F-18 pilot, I would want to get an F-16 into a slow dogfight or a one-circle fight. The F-16, we want to stay in a two-circle fight or a faster fight, a rate-type fight. And so that mindset shift between how you fly them was very different. The other portion of it, I think, is that I was qualified at one time in all variants of the F-18. So the legacy F-18 Hornet or the F-18 A through D, not the Super Hornet, is very similar in capabilities to the F-16. But the Super Hornet was a long way in technology advanced. It was very much advanced. There's a lot of things that were integrated into the systems that I didn't have to think about. Whereas when I went and flew the F-18, the legacy Hornet or the F-16, it's not as integrated. And so now your processing power has to be faster. When you combine that with being a part-time guardsman and not being proficient, it was a challenge. It was an absolute challenge. But the F-16, I always laugh as well because I should have done it the opposite way. I should have flown the F-16 first and went and flew the F-18 because F-18 is much easier on your body. The F-16 with its performance, it'll break you. And it broke me. I went from flying the F-18, which is much easier, to, you know, being 38, 39 years old and going to fly the F-16, which is much harder on your body. And, I went head to head with F-16. The F-16 broke me. So,
yeah, that's why. Because again, you ended up having to have back surgery, right? And that took you out of the jet.
I did. So, I've had three back surgeries. So, part of that is just due to a lot of playing sports. Part of that's due to flying fighters for many years. Part of that's due to probably, medically speaking, not strengthening my core like I probably should have. But I wound up having a back surgery, which kind of effectively ended my fighter career. So although I did a ton in the Navy, I wasn't able to do near as much in the Air Force in the F-16 that I wanted to do. But my squadron was really good to me. I wound up filling a lot of jobs with my squadron and helping out where I can. And honestly, to tell you the truth, it was probably one of the best things for me because I go back to there's so many things that I hadn't dealt with. And what I realized was that I had made being a fighter pilot my why or my identity.
Yeah.
And it was time for me to shift my identity from being a fighter pilot to being a good husband, to being a good father, to the things that always had taken second place in my life. And so at the time when I found out that my fighter career was coming to an end because of my back and my neck issues, I was pretty bitter. But now when I look back again, that you call it hand of providence or whatever, it was God just saying, hey, it's time for you to move on. it's time for me to shut this door, and I'm at peace with it. So it was good.
Yeah, that's great. The McIntyre, a lot of buddies at McIntyre. One of the things I think I've been fortunate to is in the last few years, kind of reconnect with the McIntyre guys. There's still obviously a lot that I fly with in my civilian job and a lot of great friends. But the one thing that kind of came about was the Guns Gear Memorial Foundation. And I'm humbled to be a part of that when sitting on the board and trying to spread the word, seeing what they have been able to do to help veterans in the last just few years since the foundation started is pretty incredible. Some families that would otherwise not really have access to financial support in their time of need, from it might be a cancer patient who needs to travel somewhere, needs childcare, paying for groceries, getting the airline ticket to get a young airman or soldier home when someone passes away. It has been humbling to see the McIntyre bros carry on Gunn's legacy through the foundation there. You showed up at McIntyre and had a little bit of overlap with Guns, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
I did. I had about 4 years of overlap with Guns.
Okay. Did you have you seen anything the foundation has been doing or just in the last couple of years, or any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, just to talk about Guns a little bit, it was interesting for me to meet Guns. And where a lot of people had a very personal relationship with him, I had more of a professional like relationship, but I think that was a huge blessing as well, because I have a perspective that I think a lot of people know, but it really meant something to me, because when I came in, I had just got done doing what Guns was doing. Guns was our weapons officer, and I had just got done doing a training officer tour in the Navy, which was the equivalent. And so I went in with a mindset of, hey, I'm going to watch how this guy does business. You know, I'm going to see how he mentors and how he treats people. And what I was always blown away with Guns is that he echoed the model of the Air Force Weapons School of humble, approachable, credible. He was always available in order to ask questions to even someone like me that was transitioning into the Air National Guard. He was humble in the fact that he was always willing to go find an answer if he didn't know it. He was very approachable. He was extremely credible. Anybody that knew Guns knew that whether you were great friends or not, he would take the time out of his day in order to teach you. And I can specifically remember going through my mission qualification training, and Guns was my instructor going through the BFM, or the basic fighter maneuver portion. And that was, again, something that we fly the jets that we came from, the F-18 Super Hornet, differently. And I wound up failing a couple flights just because I was trying to get the sight picture down of what the F-16 looks at. And I would always revert back to what the F-18's sight picture would look like. And Guns was incredibly patient. He would spend hours with me debriefing. Hey, this is the difference between a sight picture of an F-18 and a sight picture of an F-16. I'll never forget. Probably about a month before, maybe a couple weeks before Guns died, I got to have a really good conversation with him. And he had showed up in our squadron, and he had been medically down for a little bit. He had had some medical procedures done. And I sat down and I talked to him. And I was like, how are you feeling, man? He was just, you know, I was struggling with my medical issues with my back. And he was struggling with some medical issues that we really didn't know anything about. And I don't think he knew it at the time. And he said, I'm just not myself. I'm not feeling well, you know. And I said, hey, listen, man, you need to go get checked out. You know, we're getting older. I know we're unbreakable, but we're really not. We're breakable. And I remember getting the message. I was up in Lowell teaching at the time at UPS. And I remember getting the call from one of my buddies down there, letting me know that he had passed. And we've been on a text thread and everything else. But it was a massive blow to the squadron. It was a massive blow to the squadron. It was something that will stay with me forever. But I'll always remember out of Guns how approachable, humble, how approachable, and how credible he was as a weapons officer and as a person. He was an amazing person.
I think I might have crossed paths with him at a red flag, so I didn't know Guns personally. The guys I've talked to have echoed exactly what you've said there. Guys who show up to the squadron and expect one thing out of their weapons officer. And with Guns, it was a completely different thing, where he would be willing to sit there and take the time, nurture, grow and instruct, which again, that's coming out of the weapons school. I think the weapons school, again, not having gone, but a lot of weapons school buddies, they all come out with a very good mentality, right? They're there to grow the force, make the force stronger. So it's humbling to be a part of the foundation and see his legacy carried on, in my opinion, helping people in their time of need, veterans, active duty, doesn't matter who they are. It's been pretty cool to see that and the direct impact his name still having out there today.
Yeah, it's amazing. That foundation, you know, one of my good friends is Croc Atherton. We've been friends for a long time. Another one of my close friends, I would say, is a guy named Glock Mock. And there's just many people down there. It, not only just in the foundation, but you see how he has touched so many lives. I mean, you know, that squadron was radically changed for the good in a lot of ways because of his passing. And I would want him here today. I wish that hadn't happened, but there's so much good that's gone on in that squadron, in the foundation, just out of his life. And that's a testament to who he was and how many people's lives he touched. It was pretty amazing.
Well, Peaches, I hope you hang around here for a There I Was story. But before we depart, if you found 15, 16-year-old Peaches walking down the street, is there any advice you would throw to him, tell him to do something different, change something? Or
I think the biggest advice that I would say is finding your purpose. I know that's cliche, but finding your why you want to do what you want to do early. And then surrounding yourself with people that are going to help you and aid you along that journey, that are going to mentor you and that are going to hold you accountable in that journey. Mentorship to me is so important. And, you know, I'm very fortunate, very blessed by God that I got to do what I was doing. I didn't touch on it, but, you know, when I was growing up through high school, I had 7 friends that passed away from drug overdoses. Wow. And so I look back at that and I simply say, what if someone would have stepped into their life, you know, and mentored them along that way, would they still be there? I say all that to say, if I was 15 or 16 years old, I would simply say, surround yourself with your best friends that want the best for you, not that are pulling you down. And then if you can cultivate your why, your purpose on this planet. I love, there's a quote that I absolutely love. And the quote is, the two most important days of your life is the day that you're born and the day that you find out why. And I think that's so important is that we search for our purpose. So.
Now, Peach, I think that hammers it home. And I appreciate you taking the time today just to share a little bit about your story, talk some flying. And I look forward to doing it again soon. Again, I hope you hang around for a There I Was story, and we'll talk again soon.
Awesome, Ray. Thank you so much for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.